Canadian physician once called pneumonia friend of the aged, in that it often brought a swift, relatively painless death for his elderly patients, sparing them from a long, relentless decline in health. Sir William Osler wrote that back in 1892, before antibiotics or intubation or other medical technologies arrived to vastly improve our odds of surviving a late-in-life bout of pneumonia. Where we haven't managed to move the needle so much is on what happens next, when people in very poor health survive the immediate crisis but never return to their old lives. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Writer and ICU nurse Kristen McConnell has seen it many, many times. Bodies kept alive by the confluence of modern medicine, healthcare practices, and family wishes, with little hope of leaving a bed, communicating, or in some cases even waking up, let alone resuming any kind of normal life. And she can't help but wonder, is this a triumph of medicine or a tragedy? Kristen McConnell's essay, The Medical Care That Helps No One, appears in The Atlantic. Kristen, welcome to Think.
Hi, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
You have a line in this piece that I have been thinking about ever since I read it. Preventing someone from dying immediately is far easier than returning them to health. The job of the ICU is really just that first part, right? Keeping people from dying.
Yeah, I mean, the job of the ICU is to medically stabilize the patient, which means keeping them from dying. So that's, you know, there's a lot of activity that happens when a patient is first admitted to the ICU, in terms of a workup, figuring out exactly what is going on with them and what kind of interventions they need to treat them. And oftentimes, you know, that initial workup and treating them brings a lot of hope to the family, you know, that we know what's going on, that we've seen this before, and we can handle it. And we do handle it, and we do a lot of stuff to the patient. But just like you said, oftentimes when we're able to medically stabilize the patient, that really doesn't mean returning them to the kind of baseline or quality of life or level of function that they had before they got sick.
What drew you to work specifically as an ICU nurse?
Oh, that's an interesting question. When I was in nursing school, I kind of had the impression that the ICU was sort of the most exciting kind of work, maybe the most challenging, or at least challenging in that kind of adrenaline energized sense. And I don't know, I felt like it was like kind of, I don't know, like a way to rise to the occasion of being the nurse, like the hard thing to do, the thing that you would do if you were really strong, I guess. Yeah,
it's a real challenge of everything you've learned and also everything you are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's mentally challenging. It's also physically and emotionally challenging, for sure.
So you, in your work, are caring for the sickest of sick patients. We will say plenty of people receive care in the ICU and go on to make strong recoveries, of course. But a not insignificant subset are just not well positioned to get better, even if they don't die. Are there certain conditions under which, broadly speaking, it seems more likely that ICU care will not put people on a path to resuming something like a normal life?
Yeah, I think that there are a lot of conditions that have that outcome. I have always worked in neuro, so I take care of a lot of patients who have strokes or, you know, different kind of strokes, bleeds in their brain. And a lot of the more severe varieties of stroke, you know, result in people not being able to return to their lives. But outside of neuro, there are a lot of conditions. There are also a lot of patients who are sick in a lot of different ways, who have multiple things seriously going wrong in their bodies. So I think oftentimes once someone gets to that point where they have like several organ systems failing, you can say it's not likely that they're going to get back to their life.
What have you learned about which patients get excluded from studies of the effectiveness of ICU care?
Yeah, I think this is really interesting. So I was looking into this, you know, when I was working on this piece, because I was kind of hoping to find numbers about, you know, how many patients end up in this kind of situation, which for various reasons was hard to find, kind of because they don't, patients aren't really categorized in terms of what their level of consciousness is when they leave the ICU, even though, you know, that it seems like that's a pretty important thing to know about. But so what I found was that this relatively new sort of investigation into the condition of people after they have recovered and survived the ICU and are going back to, or, you know, going on to whatever is next for them, where they're talking about how people have a lot of memory problems, have PTSD, have cognitive impairment and functional impairment. That whole area of study, which seems like it might be kind of productive for getting into talking about this really incapacitated class of patients that we regularly see in the ICU, but that whole thing really just doesn't count them. It disregards them because there's not really any way for those patients to contribute to those studies.
So
they can't contribute you know, their feelings or thoughts.
Can that distort what the rest of us lay people who don't work in healthcare imagine is possible when someone who is just incredibly sick and already in poor health goes into the ICU?
Yeah, I think it absolutely does distort it.
So what is post-intensive care syndrome? Is that the combination of challenges you were just describing?
Yeah, yes, that's what I was describing there. And I mean, I think it's a really good thing for people to talk about because, I mean, that also has big implications for a large number of patients. But the fact is, when you're talking about people who have post-intensive care syndrome, and you're talking about that as the consequence or the potential negative consequence of surviving a significant stay in the ICU, you're literally disregarding this whole group of patients who, you know, are so much worse off than people who have post-intensive care syndrome.
Before we get more into the nuances of all this, Kristen, I do want to make it very clear for people who may have just joined us, you're not talking about barring patients from the ICU because they are too sick. You're not talking about limiting care for people who have made it very clear they want this.
No, absolutely not. I don't think that there's a reason to do that. First of all, I don't think that that would ever happen. It's unrealistic. Patients and families have a great deal of power in being able to make decisions about what care they get. And I think that that's a really good thing. But what I'm talking about is people need to understand what happens in the ICU. They need to be able to imagine what the possibilities are in order to actually make knowledgeable, informed choices about what kind of care they want to receive. And I think that most people don't. Most people really don't know about these types of outcomes, and they haven't ever imagined what it would be like. I certainly had no idea that there were all of these people who ended up this way, you know, discharged from the ICU unconscious for the rest of their life before I became an ICU nurse. So if I only know about it because I'm an ICU nurse, you know, I think that there are a lot of people who really just can't conceive of it.
You open the piece with the story of a young man who developed a fungal infection that ultimately led to abscesses in his brain, which is to say he had reached a kind of a point of no return.
Absolutely.
What kind of care did he receive? What kind of treatments did he receive in the ICU?
So he was intubated, of course. He would have, you know, been dead before he physically arrived in the ICU if he hadn't been intubated. His vital signs were really unstable. So he was on a lot of drips, like vasopressor drips, to maintain his blood pressure. Initially, he was very difficult to sedate. He needed to be sedated because he was intubated. He couldn't breathe without being on the ventilator, but oftentimes people have trouble working with the ventilator. So they'll do something that we call like bucking the ventilator, mm-hmm. where they're kind of coughing a lot and resisting it. And it makes the ventilator kind of not be able to successfully ventilate them. So he needed a lot of sedation, but it was very hard to sedate him. He needed multiple kinds of like big lines, for example, central line, so that he could get all of those drugs that he needed in order to be, you know, to have his vital signs be stable. He needed an arterial line, which is a line that we use so that you can monitor somebody's blood pressure continuously by measuring it from inside of their artery. And that's also used for sampling blood so that you can draw blood straight out of the artery without sticking someone. He had surgery, which was kind of the only hope for being able to save him. He was on a lot of different medications that were, you know, just used to kind of try to stabilize his brain. So try to control swelling, that sort of thing. When I wrote in the piece that he was blowing his pupils, which is like a very, very severe sign that something really bad is happening in the brain. So he was getting a sort of hyper-concentrated type of saline that you can use to sort of shrink down the brain very quickly when it's doing that. And of course he was on antifungal drugs as well. Lots of care for that young man.
It sounds, no one meant to cause him further pain, but that treatment sounds excruciating, given that all the medical professionals understood that this was not going to end well, no matter what.
That's definitely what I'm trying to say. I think it's excruciating. It's confusing when you are talking about things being painful, because I think that a lot of I think that a lot of the patients, you know, when they're that sick, they're not probably feeling pain in the way that you or I would feel pain. But you certainly feel like you're putting them through a lot of, you know, difficult stuff for their body, and you're kind of not giving them any mercy. You're also putting their family through a lot.
Kristen, another theme throughout this piece is the effect that providing this care has on you and your colleagues. And again, I'll let people know, you are not thinking that your needs or your colleagues are most important, but it does have an effect on you.
Yeah, absolutely. Nurses and doctors are people who want to help people. They want to take care of people. We love helping people get better, no matter how difficult it is, no matter how unpleasant it is. It brings us, great joy and satisfaction to help people get better. But when we are giving this really invasive care to people who we, from our experience, know are not going to get better, it really changes like the meaning of what it is that we're doing to those people. And I think it's really hard on us. And I think that in the article, I mentioned this sort of gallows humor that people develop. And it's really just a coping mechanism that people use when they feel like there's nothing that they can do about this really bizarre and pretty awful situation. And I think the fact that people kind of become hardened and jaded in that way, it actually just kind of shows how common this is, how frequently this happens, that you just kind of become desensitized to it.
Do families believe, even as they witness care that, is pretty hard to watch, do they still hold on to hope that as long as a loved one's heart is still beating in the ICU, that there's a chance for them to sort of come back to themselves?
Yeah, I think absolutely some of them do. I think it's hard for a lot of people to understand just how sick a patient can be. I think there's sort of some cognitive dissonance there with seeing how much work is going into taking care of the patient. And I think for some people it's hard to reconcile the fact that there's so much happening with the understanding that the patient is really not going to get better in a meaningful way.
I was thinking about the fact that certainly Americans and probably humans everywhere absolutely love a triumphant comeback story, right? Those tales of somebody who seemed unlikely to survive at all and goes on to actually recover. I wonder if the ones we hear distort our understanding of how uncommon they actually are.
I think that's possible. I know, everybody has sort of something that they've heard in mind. Unfortunately, I mean, obviously, it's so wonderful that that happens and it does happen. And it feels really good, for the providers, for families, for patients. But people really can be so much sicker than in a state that they can recover from and still be, receiving the intensive care.
When you note that families are often not prepared for what can happen in an ICU, what do you mean by that?
I mean, a few things. I mean, first of all, the sort of course of illness that people have when they're in an ICU is really different from a typical like end of life course of illness. So most of the time that someone is admitted to the ICU, it's surprising. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's plenty of times when someone is somewhere else in the hospital and they get sicker, so they end up coming to the ICU. But a lot of the patients that I see are people who were fine and then something horrible happens to them and they are immediately admitted to the ICU. So there's like a lot of new information for families to absorb at that time. They're trying to figure out what is going on with the patient and they're trying to figure out what we're doing to help them. And all of that stuff is really new to people. They're not really thinking about this potentially being an end of life scenario, in the way that maybe if someone had like a chronic illness and they were gradually getting sicker, their family might have anticipated that they were going to be dealing with an end of life scenario and, been able to mentally and emotionally prepare for that. But in the ICU, the course is totally different and totally unfamiliar.
Presumably, patients who do not die eventually are moved out of the ICU. But when that happens for patients who have lost the ability to speak or to eat or to move independently, you write that often those things are now treated as kind of a new normal, right? A kind of baseline condition of their existence moving forward. And it's not Absolutely. Because nobody on the medical team cares, but because folks on the medical team understand that it's likely impossible the patient will regain those abilities.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so those things become part of the patient's baseline, and that determines what kind of facility the patient can go to when they leave. And so one of the things that I really want people to understand is when the ICU is providing all of this care to a patient, that potential baseline of not being able to breathe on their own, not being able to eat, needing to have a feeding tube, not being able to move, and most importantly, not being able to communicate, is totally within the norm of possible outcomes. It happens so regularly that, you know, people barely bat an eye at discharging a patient in that condition.
And where do they go after that? Are they in some kind of rehab hospital? Do they go home?
They usually go to a long-term acute care facility. It's hard for patients to be admitted to rehab if they can't, you know, move volitionally mm-hmm. most of the time.
So you talk about a lack of health literacy in this country. What does that mean?
People don't know very much about the way that our bodies work in general. And that makes it hard to process information when someone is suddenly so sick that their body's really not functioning and that they need all sorts of interventions just to keep them from immediately dying. I think it's really hard for a lot of people to grasp really what that means in terms of how dysfunctional their body is.
How common is it for families to have a clear idea of what their loved ones want in a situation like this based on something like an advance directive?
I think, sadly, it's fairly uncommon. I think that most people don't have advance directives. And even when people have talked about it with their family, because what happens in intensive care is for the most part kind of hidden and not discussed clearly, I think that people aren't, most of the time, they're not really able to imagine these specific scenarios and picture what kind of condition they might actually be in if they get really sick.
Yeah, I can imagine someone who is relatively young and healthy thinking, well, if something happens and my heart stops, do everything you can to bring me back because I have obligations. I imagine myself maybe making a slow recovery but coming back to my life. Few of us imagine the kind of situation that you described.
Yeah, I mean, and, you know, I think it's very reasonable for people who are in good health to feel that way, to feel like do everything you can. I think that really what needs to happen, though, is that people should think of an ICU admission as kind of a trial of therapy to see if they're able to, you know, get the person to recover, with the understanding that, you know, it might not work. Like even if you see all of this action, even if we're addressing everything that we possibly can address, you know, people should realize that resuscitating someone isn't necessarily going to bring them back to a place where they would want to be.
Lacking an advance directive, Kristen, are health professionals required to do absolutely everything possible to keep patients alive regardless of their ultimate prognosis? Or what guides the decisions they make about the care to pursue?
Yeah, I think functionally they pretty much are required. I was talking about this a little bit with the editor of the piece that I was working on, and she was, you know, asking me, are they legally required to do everything? I guess in some cases they could mount a legal case against doing everything, but I don't think that that happens. I think that it's extraordinarily rare that doctors would go against the default of doing everything. I remember once when I was, you know, a new nurse and kind of just beginning to understand the way things were in the ICU, I was taking care of a patient who didn't have anybody to advocate for him. It was like a homeless patient, and he was getting a court-ordered proxy, kind of like the patient that I mentioned in the piece. And I asked a provider, I was really surprised by what we were doing for this patient because he was a couple of reflexes away from being brain dead, and he was very obviously never going to get at all better. And, you know, he was trached and pegged and on his way, you know, heading down the path of going to long-term care. And I asked a provider about, you know, isn't there a way to, you know, say that this isn't appropriate for him and not do this to him? And she literally scoffed at me and said that she didn't think that anybody was going to pony up to making an argument about futile care. I've never seen it happen.
You just mentioned a term, Kristen, brain dead, which I think maybe means one thing to healthcare professionals, and maybe to lay people sounds like not dead, right? Brain dead sounds like the body is still alive. Will you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think it is good for people to know that, because I think that that's actually one of the terms that sometimes gets accidentally used in advanced directives, because people might think that someone who's unconscious or in a vegetative state or, you know, definitely permanently unconscious is brain dead. And so they might say, you know, if I'm brain dead, don't continue care. But actually most of those people are not brain dead. If somebody is brain dead, it means that they don't even have any reflexes. So there's like a specific test that you can do on someone that would determine that they are brain dead. And when somebody is brain dead, that's kind of the only situation in which the family doesn't decide, in which the healthcare team just tells the family that unfortunately this person is brain dead and they're going to be extubated because they're legally dead. But the patients that I'm talking about are not brain dead.
How do those conversations with family members, when they are in a position, family members, to make the decisions about care for patients, how are they carried out? Does a physician, does a care team sort of sit down with a family? Do they only happen if the family's asked to initiate that kind of conversation?
No, they happen at the initiation of physicians. That happens regularly. The timing of them is kind of irregular because that really kind of depends on how the family is, you know, thinking about things, how present the family is. But it also kind of depends on how sick the patient is, because sometimes those kinds of conversations, they can get kind of bumped back and put off, you know, for various reasons, like either because not everybody is available, either on the family side or on the healthcare provider side. They can also kind of get delayed because maybe there's some results that haven't come in yet. Oftentimes the family meeting kind of becomes more pressing if the patient actually is not medically stable. And so they are looking like they're likely to need to be resuscitated when they're already in the ICU. And so that will can kind of be brought up with the family, and that might bring, more of a conversation about what is going to happen in the long term. It's good to have those conversations because, the chance of someone who is already in the ICU and then needs to be resuscitated are, probably even worse than the chances of someone who needs to be resuscitated when they haven't already been admitted to the ICU because, all of their problems are already being addressed and yet they're still that unstable. But when patients are medically stable, and so they've kind of gotten past that, really critical period when they first come in, and now they've kind of like settled down into their, baseline, and they're becoming less sick, so they're heading towards being discharged. The family meetings aren't really as pressing because of how normal it is to discharge people in that condition.
Kristen, another fact you bring up in this is that an emphasis on keeping people just alive for as long as possible can mean they don't receive a lot of palliative care, care designed to make individuals as comfortable as possible at the very end of life. What have you learned about who's most likely to receive palliative care?
I think that people are more likely to receive care when they in a higher socioeconomic position, more educated. To me, it doesn't really seem that surprising that people who, are more comfortable, asking for what they need, more comfortable intervening, are people who are in a higher socioeconomic position. But I think that that's really sad because everybody needs to have access to and receive palliative care.
What have you witnessed in terms of family members when there's a disagreement on the best course of action? How do they work through making decisions about continuing or suspending care or initiating a resuscitation if one becomes necessary?
Well, sadly, when families have an internal disagreement about what is best for the patient, that's kind of a situation where the patient ends up just being held in the ICU, sometimes for kind of a long time. And I think that that is really hard because you don't ever want to feel like a family is being rushed to make a decision about whether their loved one is going to live or die. First of all, it's a very strange position to put families in the first place, to make them responsible for these choices, when in fact it's like the severity of the person's illness that is, putting them at the end of their life. But I think that when that happens, when families are kind of just not ready or they're thinking about it, oftentimes they're not really thinking very much or paying very much attention to the actual patient who's living through those hours and days in really bad circumstances with a really horrible quality of life.
How common is it for family members to maybe know somewhere deep inside that a loved one's prospects are really grim, but insist on extraordinary life-saving measures because they worry it might be perceived as somehow disloyal to pull back from those measures?
Yeah, I think that I think it is pretty common. I also think that this is something that is really difficult about the specifically the ICU situation, which is that when people are in the ICU for a while, There's kind of, like I said before, there's that initial period of time when they're really sick and they need the workup, and maybe they're on lots of drips and they're intubated through their mouth. And that's when, that's kind of the point at which it might be easiest for families to let someone go. But as time goes on, when a patient becomes medically stable, and maybe, say, for example, they get a tracheostomy so that they're not intubated through their mouth anymore, they just have, the tracheostomy, so the ventilator is connected to their neck, so their face looks kind of more normal, and maybe they're on less medication, they become more stable. And the thing that's really difficult about that is that they might be they're more medically stable, so they're not as close to death, but they're also not better in terms of, returning to their life, waking up. But I think it's harder for families to let someone go when they've reached that point.
Surely no scientist who invents a new technology to keep the human body functioning when it is gravely ill or injured imagines causing more suffering. How does it happen that new technologies to keep bodies alive become standard for every patient with failing organs, once they're available?
How does it happen? I mean, I think that's kind of the march of technology in general, right? I guess it's just you're not gonna deny people a technology that's available. So it's kind of similar to what's happening with different kinds of technology right now. Like, we develop these things that are very powerful. We want to use them. It's in our nature to do all the things that we can do, and we don't really think it through what all of the effects and all of the implications are going to be. So now we're faced with this situation where we have this amazingly powerful thing, these machines, ventilators, ECMO, all different sorts of things, as well as amazingly powerful drugs that can keep people alive. And we've failed to kind of explain to everybody that now that we have these things, we have to be really, really careful about how we use them, because it's very easy to end up using them to give someone a really unacceptable quality of life. And we need to kind of show everybody that it's important to be really responsible about how we use these things, and actually that it's patients and family members who now have this responsibility. They have this burden of making choices about these things.
If a family member, a loved one, asks you what the right thing is to do, are you allowed to respond?
Yeah, I'm allowed to respond. I mean, I think that people, everybody has sort of their different level of comfort with talking about stuff. But I have almost never been asked what I think the right thing to do is. And I think that's part of what's so confusing about having someone in intensive care. I think it's really hard for people to imagine that these nurses and doctors who are doing all of this stuff to the patient, might not think that this is the right thing to do.
I struggle to ask this question because I don't want it to be perceived incorrectly, but I wonder if it's ever appropriate for families to think about sort of the cost and resources of this care, given the unlikelihood that it will give the patient back to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's kind of a whole nother subject. So, I mean, of course, we know that the costs of healthcare in this country are out of control. And Of course, if we're talking about feudal care, there's some financial implication there. I didn't really want to get into that in the piece that I wrote because, for one, because it's not an area that it's not my area of expertise. I'm not like familiar with all of those numbers, but also I actually don't think that it's necessary to bring that consideration into an argument about making intensive care more humane for patients. I think that the thought that we might want to limit care because it is costly, it might kind of scare people away from thinking about what the benefit, what the good reasons for limiting care in some situations would be.
Yeah, to make the point again, you're not talking about rationing care because it's expensive. You're talking about what actually is best for the patient. It's just so hard in our culture to think that dying can be best in any situation for any reason.
It is hard. I mean, probably not just in our culture, probably for everybody. But I just think that there's this whole other part to dying that happens in the ICU that people are really uninformed about. And that's sad because I think that if people could picture and could imagine what these things are like and could talk about them ahead of time with their families, I think a lot of people would have better outcomes, better quality of life at the end of their life.
Kristen, ICU workers, probably all hospital workers, do know what it looks like when someone is sort of in this state of suspended animation for days or weeks or months. You've found that many people in your profession are adamant about their wishes, right? What do people in your business want? God forbid they should find themselves in the kind of situation you're describing, in the ICU with little hope of recovery.
I think a lot of people have expressed that they just don't want to deal with it. They know how hard it is on families. They know how hard it is on the patients. One thing that we haven't talked about yet is, I mean, there are so many ways in which this affects patients' bodies that they might seem kind of unimportant from the outside, but if you're a nurse and you're the person who's doing these things to somebody's body on a regular basis, you really start to think about whether you would want this to happen to you. I'm talking about small things that maybe don't count. They don't really, they, I mean, not that they don't count, but they're not considered big burdens of care. But for example, like suctioning a patient or catheterizing them because they're retaining urine, and we don't let people have more than a certain amount of urine in their bladder because it's going to be stretched out, even though this person is at the end of their life and is never going to wake up. We'll still do stuff like that very routinely. And so we kind of see what it's like for people to have their bodies handled in this way by strangers, by nurses. And that kind of care, it makes a lot of sense if what you're doing is supporting the person in their healing and helping them get better. But when you know that that's not what you're doing, when you know that you're just keeping them on the treadmill of continuous medical care, it really takes on a different tone, and it can sometimes feel quite sinister. So for that reason, I think that a lot of people who work in healthcare feel quite strongly that they don't want to end up in that position.
What has kept you from burning out on this work? Is it the fact that some of your patients, in fact, do recover and do get significantly better once they leave the ICU?
Of course, I mean, it feels amazing to help people get better. That absolutely is part of it. It's very satisfying. I mean, a lot of people, yeah, I mean, burnout is a huge thing in healthcare in general, and also in intensive care, because of course you can, you know, if you feel very disturbed by this, you can always transfer to another unit. You can go work in hospice care or palliative care. They would be happy to have you. For me personally, I kind of early on, when I started doing this work and found out about this very strange problem that I didn't know about before, I wanted to stay in it largely because I think it's important to talk about it and to kind of be able to share knowledge about it, because I think that that is something that's going to help it change.
Kristen McConnell is an ICU nurse and a writer. Her essay, The Medical Care That Helps No One, appears in The Atlantic. Kristen, thank you so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you so much for having me on, Chris.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram, and you can get the podcast wherever you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or you can listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.